This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
As for today, I have the pleasure of introducing the person who's going to introduce Charles Long. But let me just say first that when we began this semester, planning this semester, our prime directive was to bring Charles Long to the University of Pennsylvania. And I'm thrilled that we've been able to do so. And so let me now introduce Professor LaFleur to introduce Charles Long.
Thank you. I'm Bill LaFleur in Japanese Studies here. I just told Professor Long a story that I want to tell you all. That's that when I was in Japan before I went back to graduate school and I was intending to study Japanese religion, I met at the time, a student of Charles Long and others at Chicago who was visiting Japan at the time. And long before the word Rainbow Coalition was used by anyone, this person used that term, in a sense, to me, to describe why I should go to Chicago. He said, if you go to study religion at the University of Chicago, he said, you will have Mircea Eliade, who is this European who will represent the religions of the West, and you will study with Joseph Kitagawa, who is an Oriental, and you will study the religions of East Asia, and you'll have Charles Long, who will teach you about the religions of Africa. And it's my first knowledge of the name Charles Long, and little did I realize when I got to Chicago that studying with Charles Long would be one of the greatest things that I ever have had in my life. He opened up so much about African religion to me at that point. And also gave these wonderful seminars on the philosophy of modern Europe, which was just marvelous at that time. And I have appreciated him ever since that point. At that point, he had published his Alpha, The Myths of Creation, a marvelous book of anthologizing creation myths throughout the world. Up to that point in my career, I thought of creation myths as pretty much limited to those of the ancient Near East. But Professor Long's book, demonstrated what a universal theme that was. He has been a professor at the University of Chicago when I was there, at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, subsequently. And most recently in the Department of Religious Studies at UC Santa Barbara. We know him as someone who has traveled widely throughout the world, observing religion, talking about the way people interact with one another in incredibly rich ways. And for me, it's a great privilege to have him here today, too. And we welcome you and hope that this is the first of many visits to our university. Charles.
Thank you very much. I've been to Philadelphia many times, and I've even been to this campus several times, but I haven't been to a more pleasant group or time of a year than here, so I appreciate very much this occasion. The title of this talk is Problematics for Study of W.E.B. Du Bois's The Souls of Black Folk, and The Secret of the Cargo. Well, let me begin with a personal note. For the last two decades, I've been concerned about the study of religion in the academic community. On the occasion of the inauguration of the MA degree in religious studies at the University of Colorado, I voiced some of my concerns. The issues involved in this quandary are theoretical and practical, as well as posing the problem of the relationship between the theoretical and the practical. Obviously, such considerations produce critical attitudes to one's own academic discipline, as well as to one's life and work. These issues have led me to undertake a critical evaluation of the neutral languages that have undergirded a great deal of the discussion in my field, the history of religions. I found, for example, that pressure had to be applied to the notions primitive and civilized. More than this, however, I felt that some new form of data had to appear, something that moved us away from the languages of Orientalism, primitivism, and the religions of monotheism. This new kind of data, like all original data, would have already been there, but not yet manifested itself, and thus not yet discovered. I hope in this project to carry out a relocation and a reallocation of the problems for the study of religion. Suppose, for example, in the first decade of this century, we located the problematic of beginnings in another place. Instead of defining an ill-specified temporal beginnings lost within the disciplinary structures of archaeology, paleontology, and primitivism, and stylized in the cultural languages of heroic discoveries, illicit relations, and the obscuring discourses of clarity and objectivity, why not, I say, begin in the wonderful phrase of the late doyen of American anthropology, Alfred Kroeber, why not, I say, begin in the full light of history? Not, however, any history, but more precisely in the history of the Western Hemisphere. We might ponder why in the year 1992, the 500th anniversary of the Columbian event, no major celebrations took place in the Western Hemisphere. It is interesting to note that we did not celebrate this heroic and well-attested discovery. Somewhere en route, things just got out of hand. Edmundo O'Gorman, in his The Invention of America, calls us to pause and ponder the very language of discovery. More recently, Jose Pedra's article, The Game of Critical Arrival, forced us to raise anew the epistemological issue of the constitution of the self in the context of this new world of space and time. Just how does one really arrive in a constitutive manner in such a place? And at the same time, keeping apace with these novel interventions has been the exfoliation of a new historical, archaeological, literary, and even ecological meanings of the new world. The Latin American and African American novels are becoming preeminent forces on the empirical and metaphorical languages of the new world, and through them, renewing and making accessible again the seminal works of C.L.R. James and Walter Rodney. In creating a language of legitimacy through persuasive power, the world of the new world has been reinvigorated with the possibility of utopia, the place of no place, and yet at the same time, a most definite concrete time and space. It is within the orders and flexibilities of this kind that I've carried on research with my graduate students over the last two decades, exploring, learning, and exercising attentiveness to issues of this kind. Through these investigations, I've returned to the concrete and imaginary meaning of origins. My academic propensities have convinced me that one of the best ways of going forward is first to go back and go down. I look for the future not in futuristic enlightenment meanings of progress, but rather in a future that involves the renewing of the human image in its resuscitation in the care of the dead and the ancestors, in the reclamation of space, time, and the human face. A new arche. Now, I'm using the term arche. You don't go far too much. I started with studying primitives, and then I found out that's not so hot, the word. But then the arche is the sort of a Greek equivalent of primitive, but I'm using it in a different way. it's beginning, but it's also principle. It's also a principle, and it's also a novelty. I wish to voice another language of the Columbian venture, a critical language of discovery derivative from the notion of O'Gorman's invention and an interrogation of the meaning of arriving and being here from Jose Petra. These discernments have prompted my return to W.E.B. Du Bois's The Souls of Black Folk. I've returned to Du Bois, to an early and even naive Du Bois, and I might add to the most pervasive and popular meaning of Du Bois for my interpretation of the New World. I've known for some time that this text had an importance beyond its conventional understanding, but I could not articulate this new vision of the text. To be sure, this is Du Bois's text. This is the Du Bois text that everyone knows. But looked at within the total corpus of Du Bois, a case could be made that this text constitutes the juvenilia of his youthful aspirations, something that should be appreciated in this context and then forgotten. This has not been the case. The text reigns in its own right, having gone through some 40 editions and translations, making a mark and defining a trace. The text remains as a critical signature on all his subsequent publications. The Souls of Black Folk, as have many other texts of human culture, gone beyond its author. I've chosen this text as the basis for a commentary so that it may exemplify the meaning of another beginnings of the new world, a new arcade. By arcade, I'm suggesting three interrelated meanings: beginnings, ultimate undisclosed principle, an underlying substance. These meanings will be explored in my commentary. What is entailed in the commentary as a literary genre? I want to go through this to express why I'm taking the commentary form to talk about Du Bois, and how that relates to my concern about a new discussion and new data for religion. The meaning will be explored in my commentary. Now, what is the commentary as a literary genre? We know commentaries best through the sustaining presence of the biblical commentary. In North America, innumerable texts are published each year as commentaries on the biblical canon. The accumulation of these commentaries on the Bible has kept the genre of the commentary alive. There is, of course, a more generalizing meaning of the commentary. One is able to use the commentary in the form of a critical edition, that is, establishing the text, or taken in the broader sense of contextualizing a text within an oeuvre. Both these descriptions of the ranges and meanings of the commentary as a literary genre describe the perduring meaning of the commentary as a theoretical and practical mode of literary creation within the traditions of Western culture. The commentary in its most popular form is still, however, rooted to its relationship to the descriptive and critical editions and elucidations of the biblical text. This kind of commentary defines the locus of authority of the genre, for implicit in the extension of the genre, implicit, for in the commentary a discrete and sophisticated borrowing takes place. When the genre of the commentary is extended beyond its relationship to the biblical canon, one borrows an older form, commentary on the Bible, to generate an antithetical transference of authority and meaning into another arena of authority, while at the same time displacing the former locus of authority as having legitimation. In this extension of the meaning of the commentary, it appears as a clever legitimate within the stylistics of modernity. In choosing The Souls of Black Folk for a commentary, I intend to enhance this classical text with the heuristic meanings of a canonical and thus authoritative text of modernity. Let me return to the commentary as that kind of osmotic literary genre between the past and modernity. In one famous commentary, Karl Barth's Roma Brief, that is Barth's commentary on the Epistle to the Romans, Barth ambivalently uses, enhances, and breaks with the genre of the commentary by refusing to abide by the rules of the objectivity of the biblical canon. There are few, if any, footnotes. No appeal to other texts. No sophisticated analysis of the meaning of the Greek or other languages in this commentary. They all knew that Barth was capable of the highest forms of the mechanics of conventional commentary. He chose to do something different, to establish this text as his manifesto within the mouth of the canonicity of the Pauline epistles, texts that in another style had already been canonized. So the issue here is rather subtle, for one cannot reject his commentary as simply an episodic idiosyncratic act, since the commentaries of the New Testament have a venerable tradition from the early church through the Reformation to the Puritans and on into the present. The historical tradition legitimated the commentary form. Barth did something different while accepting the tradition of his genre. He at the same time dared that tradition in his own terms. So no matter where you stand in relationship with Barthian theology, one must give him credit for the audacious reconfiguration of the genre of interpretation of a canonical text. Though the genre of the through the genre of the commentary, he placed the eternity of the text within the context of the modern, but not as apologia, but as a limit, container, threat to the claims of the existentially modern, while simultaneously identifying modernity and eternity as the same locus of brilliant tour de force. There's yet another kind of modern commentary that I would like to say a word or two about. It is exemplified by Max Black's commentary on Wittgenstein's Tractatus. Though it is not titled as a commentary, it is in fact one. All the chapters go under the heading of Commentary on Wittgenstein's Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus. Thus, this companion commentary, which in many respects reverts back to an old biblical commentary mode, intends to justify Wittgenstein's status as a radical innovator in the philosophy of modernity. It situates the Tractatus in relationship to the logical investigations, the notebooks, and several articles and discussions about the philosophy of Wittgenstein. In this intellectual movement, the Tractatus is renewed as a philosophical meaning. My commentary on Du Bois's The Souls of Black Folk will lie somewhere between Karl Barth's Roma Brief and Max Black's commentary on Wittgenstein's Tractatus. Our text, however, does not lie simply within and amongst similar texts of contemporaneity. In my explorations to find a locus for the souls, I chanced upon another New World commentary. The author was Garcilaso de la Vega, and his work was Royal Commentaries of the Incas and the History of Peru. Now, what is most interesting about de la Vega is that his mother was Inca and his father Spanish. He lived in the duality of the conquering West and the vanquished world of the Incas. The foreword to the University of Texas translation of this text is written by the late Arnold J. Toynbee. There are two points I should like to note in this foreword. In commenting on De La Vega's double descent, Toynbee says, thanks to his mixed Andean European descent and to his initiation into both his ancestral traditions, a double education which was his privilege or burden of his mestizo blood, Garcilaso was able to serve and did serve as an interpreter or mediator between two different cultures that had suddenly been brought into contact. This is the first point I wish to make, and the second follows closely upon it. Toynbee goes on to say, a special name was invented in the Russian language for this interpreter class. After the Russian people had been brought into intimate relations with the West at the turn of the 17th and 18th centuries, the new class of Western-educated and Western-minded Russians that this encounter called into existence came in the 19th century to be called the intelligentsia. The hybrid word, this hybrid word with a French root and a Russian termination, was coined to denote something new in the Russian experience. Toynbee goes on to place Garsilaska within a distinguished company, Berossus, who interpreted Babylon to the Greeks, Manetho, the Egyptian, Philo and Josephus among the Jews, Radha Krishna from India in our own time, and we might add several others, including Nkrumah, Mandela, and several ex-colonized leaders and intellectuals from all over the world. Toynbee's language hides both structural and critical, structural and historical situations in a neutral language of impact, contact, and mixtures. He overlooks the relation of between the conquest and the necessity for creative thinking and action on the part of those oppressed, and thus he fails to give a true and fundamental meaning to the notion of intelligentsia. In so doing, Toynbee fails to perceive the structure of an arche in the modality of their thought. Now, before going into the substance and structure of Du Bois's Souls, let me give a brief biography of Du Bois, just in case you've forgotten. He was born in Great Barrington, Massachusetts in 1868. He died in Accra, Ghana, shortly after renouncing his U.S. citizenship in 1963. At the time of his death, he was working on an encyclopedia of Africa. His death was announced at the Great Civil Rights March in Washington, D.C. in 1963, where Martin Luther King delivered his famous I Have a Dream speech. Du Bois attended Fisk University in Nashville, Tennessee, then Harvard for graduate study. During his graduate studies at Harvard, he spent 2 years in Europe, primarily at the University of Berlin. He received a Ph.D. from Harvard in 1895. His dissertation was titled The Suppression of the African Slave Trade to the United States, 1683 to 1870, and it was published in Harvard series, a historical series in 1896. Souls, originally published in 1903, was his third book, the second being The Philadelphia Negro, which appeared in 1899. With this auspicious beginning in the world of letters, he moved into a prolific publishing and activist life. Just a word or two about his study in Berlin. I had thought, when I looked at that, that I would find that he had studied he'd studied about Hegel and whatever and all that. And what I found is that the persons he studied with were not the, whom you might expect. Heinrich von Treitschke, Rudolf von Niest, who was in law, history of law, and Gustav Schmoller. Now, Gustav Schmoller, that's very important, because Gustav Schmoller was an economist. And Gustav Schmoller was putting forth a theory, a non-mercantile theory of economy. Gustav Schmoller was saying there is an alternative to mercantilist theory. And he was not, Du Bois not only studied with him, he was Du Bois' champion. Because Du Bois wanted to stay one more year to take the Berlin degree. But his money and situation at Harvard had run out, and he asked his teachers if they would write letters and tell them to send him more money and give him more time, and Schmoller was right there at the head of that list, and of course they said Harvard said no. What is also interesting about Schmoller is that the other great intellectual influenced by Schmoller was Ferdinand Braudel. Ferdinand Braudel of the Arnauld School, see, who has written these great volumes on the history of modern economy. And of course, you know him by the Mediterranean and the Mediterranean world and the, during the reign of Philip II. So here you're beginning to see some interrelationships of meanings and thought centering around smaller people who never talk to each other. Du Bois's publications cover almost every literary genre. He's responsible for 4 autobiographies. See, if you live a long time, you can just can write your life any way you want. Several historical monographs and hundreds of articles. As editor of The Crisis, the organ of the NAACP, he was at the forefront of all issues that affected the meaning, nature, and role of persons of African descent in the United States in particular and in the world at large. 11 biographies of Du Bois have appeared. Professor David Levering at Rutgers has just completed the 2nd volume of his definitive work on Du Bois. So if you really want to know about Du Bois and don't want to read all these others, get David's 2 big volumes. They're very good. Now, I must, in my work, obviously take account of all the literature by and about Du Bois, but it is not my intent to write yet another biography, not simply to discuss the meaning of souls within the context of his previous and subsequent work. The intent of my commentary is quite different, radically different. From a certain point of view, I will remove the text from the previous context of discussion, even from the discussions of the life and intent of the author. I wish to establish another authority for the text by resituating it within the new world. I intend to treat it as a text of beginnings, one of the seminal and archaic texts of the vision of the vanquished. The Souls is the most popular and lasting work of Du Bois, probably because it contains some of his most quotable sayings. Even those who don't know where they are, where what they're saying comes from, have memorized them. For example, it is here that the symbolism of the veil is first articulated. This is the text of a double consciousness. This is the place where he asserts that the problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line. Much has already been made of these highly quotable and apt statements in the history of African-American rhetoric and thought. I shall not ignore these powerful phrases, but I shall attempt to use them as deciphering tools, critical indices that will allow me to see how the text undertakes a reorganization of thought and meaning in the modern period. 3, dualities. How does it feel to be a problem? Now, in the first sentence of the first chapter of Souls, Du Bois sets forth a stylistics that is carried on in a relentless manner throughout the text. Between me and the other world, there is ever an unasked question. I mean, the rhetorical form. Between me and the other world, there is ever an unasked question. Unasked by some through feelings of delicacy, by others through the difficulty of framing it. Later in the same chapter, he makes the most quotable of his statements. The Negro is sort of a 7th son, born with a veil and gifted with 2nd sight in an American world. See how these funny numerical changes are taking place, simply on a linguistic level. Let's forget the meaning. This is linguistically. The Negro is sort of a 7th son, born with a veil, gifted with 2nd sight in this American world. A world which yields him no true self-consciousness, but only lets him see himself through the revelation of the other world. It is a peculiar sensation, this double two, again, double consciousness, this sense of always looking at one's self through the eyes of others, of measuring one soul by the tape of a world that looks in amused contempt, looks on in amused contempt and pity. One ever feels this two-ness, an American, a Negro, two souls, two thoughts, two unreconciled strivings, two warring ideals in one dark body whose dogged strength alone keeps it from being torn asunder. The duality of this first chapter is adumbrated again in chapter 3, Mr. Washington and others, and in chapter 9 of the Sons of Masters and Man, and especially chapter 13 on the coming of John. And the chapter on the coming of John, there are two Johns. And these two Johns come from the same place in the South. One is the sort of rich white boy, and the other one is the poor black boy. They grew up in the same town. As a matter of fact, as was the custom in the South, they played together when they were kids. And of course, Rich John goes off. It's not clear what school it is, but it sounded like Princeton. Because those kind of Southern people were apt to send their children to Princeton. I taught at Princeton once and I saw them there. What happened in the story, as he tells it, is Black John goes to New York, as black people have to do in their migratory peregrinations, and he goes to a concert. The white John is there with his girlfriend, and he doesn't know, they don't recognize each other, but he sits there next to them just because the seat was there. And of course, the white John did not want his girlfriend sitting next to the black John, so he gets on the move, and then he begins to make remarks about black people. Well, I won't tell the rest of the story. But you see, now we have the two-ness again. We have the two-ness now with two distinct persons who ought to be one. They were raised in the same place, knew each other, came from the same place, but they are two. So that whole doubleness of consciousness becomes something more than just an internal construction of consciousness in the purely phenomenological sense. Anyway, let's move on. In his first chapter, and throughout the Souls, Du Bois muses on the existential, ontological, and historical constitution of the soul formed in the Western Hemisphere and in the new global culture. Du Bois was not the first to pose the issue of the constitution of the soul or self in the world of modernity. This meaning has a long tradition in the modern world, extending from Descartes through Kant to Jefferson in North America. It becomes a whole question of, can there be a soul in the world of modernity? Or you could put it, if the issue of soul is even explored, it means that its possibility is already problematical. And if you begin with Descartes' explorations, then you begin to see that it's a very paradoxical and strange mode that in trying to discover what this self-soul might be, he poses it as a problem of knowledge rather than a problem of life. As a matter of fact, his meditations are meditations which allow you to move away from any sensual meaning of the self or soul as life to its problematic as a thinking subject. Now that's the beginning of it. And then we move through Kant, and so we're going to go through that, but the commentary will. The fortune of the modern self is non-problematical, singular, and possessing the purity in regard to itself is the legacy of this tradition, a tradition that has been taken up in the new cosmology of mercantile capitalism. In other words, I want to begin to look at this whole problem of the possibility of a soul in the modern world, because I think that's what he's posing. And I think this becomes a real issue, not only methodologically, but also as raising the question of what is religion, because religion is supposed to be about human beings, and then what would be the locus of the person or the human if humans are supposed to have religion? Where would you find it? You ought to find it among humans. Well, you have to locate where that might be. So it raises this issue, and it raises it within the structures of the cosmology of mercantile capitalism. Now, Du Bois, in Souls of Black Folk, is orienting us to another country of the soul, or another field for the exploration of the soul. Of our spiritual strivings, the title of the first chapter, is in fact an orientational meditation on the space and time of a new country of the soul, a soul that has been ingressed in contradistinction to Descartes, for example, has been ingressed by its thickness and plurality, a soul made to bear the weight of its extension, a soul both inward and outward, a soul that partakes of the blackness of flesh and the terror of history, a soul that is dual or plural in its very constitution, textured in the thickness of time, vulnerable to the valences of power, a soul seeking a world equal to the terrain of its time and space. Now, this is what I want to push in my commentary on Du Bois, to raise the problem of the soul in the modern world. Let me put it another way. If I compare the modern world, and by the modern world, I'm almost making that synonymous to the Atlantic world, to the world revealed through the meaning of the Atlantic. And the other great world, if we want to use the metaphor of the water, was the Mediterranean world. The Mediterranean world was the one place where the largest number of non-homogeneous people met constantly over a long period of time. It was a great world. But it was also a world for the gestation of gods. Everywhere you look in the Mediterranean world, there are these divine beings here, there, and yonder, with all sorts of names, Egyptian or Mesopotamian or Greek or Phoenician, Christian, Hebrew, you name it, they're there. If you're in the Mediterranean, you presuppose that God's around. I mean, you can be an atheist and say, of course gods are here. The Atlantic world is a very different world. The Atlantic world is a world of freedom, a world of human freedom, a world that allows you to deny non-human agency, a world of democratic values, a world of progress, a world of human beings on their way. No gods emerge out of the Atlantic. The Atlantic is sterile when it comes to gods. Except maybe a negative revelation. That is, maybe simply a space made for the possibility of a God and a self. And I see this in the introduction of African bodies into the Atlantic world. Because with the introduction of African bodies in the Atlantic world, all those meanings of the Atlantic world are contradicted. That is, all those meanings of the freedom, all those meanings of progress, all those meanings of all these things are denied. And they're denied in a very concrete and specific way, in a very radically empirical way, because it was not the case that Africans got in the water and came over and then they had to make do. It was the fact that the Africans are here because all those other people are here. As a matter of fact, people forget this, they were on the same boat. And so in the bowels of that ship, where one is cut off from whatever resources that non-human agency called God had in one's culture, and going to a place where no one was going to make available anything of that sort, in the bowels of that ship, maybe there is the space for the negative revelation of God, the negative meaning of a soul, the space for a soul that is not yet there. And it's along these lines that I will be pushing this commentary. Now, the plan of the work. There are several editions of the text about, and so I have to establish the one I want to use for my commentary, and then I have to divide it into suitable units so I can make use of it the way I want to. I'm thinking now of the edition by Aptheker, who was his literary executor, and to use that text. Then I want to deal with the material shapes of language. I get this term, material shapes of language, from a work done by Ann Kibbe in her work called The Interpretation of Material Shapes in Puritanism, a Study in Rhetoric, Prejudice, and Violence. What Ann Kibbe does here is to look primarily at the sermons of John Winthrop, because she sees that there is an interrelationship between this, what she calls the shapes of language. Their kind of figural and iconic structure to what Winthrop is saying, that through his sermons, not just the meaning of his words, but almost the iconic structure of them, lead to persuasion, and in this case, persuasion to violence against the Native Americans. But I see here another meaning of material shape of language in Du Bois, how forms of his language carry a material form, because he is seeking for a language as close to the empiricities that he's trying to speak about. And this is carried through with the musical epigraphs at the beginning of each chapter. So these material shapes evoke the other meaning of materiality related to African bodies, labor, and the gross matter of the economic system of slavery and plantation system. Then I will deal with the archaism of the text. By this term, I'm pointing to the powerful orientational nature of the text as defining foundational structures of modern religion, society, and economy. It is the interweaving of these themes into a poetical and discursive structure that evokes the powerful meaning of the soul. And I will place this text within the context of other, what I call, mythological philosophies. For example, Hobbes, Locke, Adam Smith, Marx, etc., who for all their insight find it necessary to eliminate the spiritual, religious, and material meaning of the soul. The appearance of African bodies within the structures of the Atlantic world of modernity, the civilizing world of democratic values and mercantilism, defines a discontinuity when confronted with the bodies of Africans who are brought into this world as slave laborers. They become the center around which theories of economy, human value, and social epistemology will revolve for the entire modern period. The text cannot therefore be limited to simply the situation of African peoples in the United States, though it arises out of this context. If the problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line, then it is simultaneously the problem of various forms of colonialism, neocolonialism, and meanings of peoples and selves all over the world. How does it feel to be a problem? I think many Americans are asking that. Now, why would I call this the secret of the cargo? I call it the secret of the cargo because what began in the Atlantic world became the germ for what scholars call the New World System, or what today we call the global economy. That is, what happened in the Atlantic world has extended to every other part of the world. And this cargo, in the Atlantic world, the cargo that I'm speaking of is the cargo of African slaves, yes, but also that other cargo, the regular stuff, trade stuff. Because it wasn't simply African slaves. African slaves were part of the whole commodity exchange. Rum, cotton, sugar, slaves, they were interchangeable because of certain notions of the economy in terms of equivalences of value, which arise not only out of a certain kind of monetary system, but also out of a certain form of economic thinking, which also begins in the modern period. If you try to find a history of economic thought, and the person is worth their salt, you will see you do not have economy as something you can simply think about like that until the modern period in the Atlantic world. The people, Ricardo and so forth and so on. A good man to read on that is Schumpeter. Before this time, the word economy in terms of its popular parlance, or even the origin of its use in a popular sense, strangely enough, was related to the doctrine of the Trinity. It was in Tertullian's De Trinitate, when he is trying to tell you why God is one but three, or why God is three but one. He says, well, you see, there are two meanings of the Godhead. One is God Ase, God for God's self, in God's self, and by God's self. That is God totally unrelated to the world or anything else. And then there's the economic meaning. The economy of God. Now, the economy of God is how God relates to the world, which is how the power of God extends over a field of meaning. Economy. And the first meaning of that word in terms of those traditions inherited by the West had to do with God made the world. In the Atlantic world, the meaning of economy changes radically. As a matter of fact, economy gets tied up in very complex ways with the disappearance of God from the world. And this is tied up directly with those of us who are historians of religion and back to beginnings again. Because in the 17th and 18th century, one of the most popular theories of the beginnings of religion was the notion of the fetish. And where did the fetish come from? The fetish is really Portuguese. And the Portuguese had been in Africa before the other Europeans got into the slave trade in this way. But it's a long story, but when you read the book, you'll see why it's important. Those people that they thought were Africans were really polyglot little societies living on these very small little islands right off the coast of what is now Guinea-Bissau and Senegal. They were mixed up people. They were some Africans who had run away or one way or another got there away from their own groups. There were people there from the Mediterranean world. They were just sort of polyglot. And when the Portuguese saw them, one, they asked, because they were selling under Christian monarch, they always have to ask you what your religion is, because if you're not Christian, they have to do something about it. And they said, what is your religion? And they didn't understand, of course, because they didn't speak the language. But finally, they got around, and he said, this thing around your neck? And they said, that's gold. We like gold. Portuguese like gold, of course. Say, well, can we give you this cloth? Oh, yeah. So they have this notion now that we have found a people. We found a people who have a portable God. A portable God, which God is interchangeable for other things. A portable God that has no inherent value, only has exchange value. Now, this whole notion of the fetish, it went like wildfire all over Europe. People started writing all kinds of books about it. Other people went there and made up things and so forth. And even the Roman Church that, you know, usually look at this stuff because they got all kinds of theories of people who are worshiping things that are not the right God. Idolaters and whatever. This was never subjected to any theological critique or discussion by any Roman Catholic theologian. Amazing. Absolutely amazing. And next thing you know, we find Hegel making use of this to talk about Africans. Newton has a book on the fetish in his study. It is taken to be the thing. Okay, of course, it's a wrong understanding of African religion, but that's not the point I want to make. The point I want to make is that Westerners claim the meaning of the fetish and reverse the thing. So the fetish becomes the commodity. And Marx is wrong talking about commodity fetishism. It's redundant. The fetish and the commodity are the same. Now, we have a similar situation with a reversal in the Pacific, where we see natives of Melanesia who tell the Europeans who come in large boats with all these goods and tin cans of food and nails, etc., this is just some stuff. We just happen to have this stuff with us. but we came here to teach you about God and Jesus. And the melody said, okay. Until finally, after a few decades, they say, you know what? You've been fooling us. You don't worship God and Jesus as you've been telling us to do. We look at you because oppressed people always are very precise and careful looking at their oppressors. You worship the cargo. Now, what was a fact in the Atlantic world is now stated to be the truth in the Pacific world. Because the people in the Atlantic will never tell you they worship the cargo. So the whole interrelationship of the cargo as having something to do with Africa, the cargo as African bodies, the cargo as having something to do with the origin of the meaning of why people are religious, the cargo as being the locus for either the meaning of soul or the denial of soul, will be part of another kind of twosome that I will make in my commentary. So the problem here of the problem of the 20th century, the problem of the color line, is also raised by asking it from a Pacific Rim point of view, what is the secret of the cargo? Because the secret of the cargo and the meaning of the soul must go together. One cannot have soul for real anymore unless one deals with the materialities of the world. That soul is no longer an escape from the world. Soul cannot be a way of believing yourself out of the world. Soul itself must deal with the forms of its beginnings in the material structures of the modern Atlantic world. Finally, I will deal with theories of exchange. Two independent issues come to fore here. One is the necessity of exchange and its implications for the creation and sustenance of human community. The other has to do with the valuation of human exchange and the source of human value. These issues are at the heart of both religion and the economy. And then, of course, I will contextualize my commentaries within the theories of post-colonial thought and of various contemporaries, Frantz Fanon, Ashish Nandi, Edward Glisson, James Cone, Cornel West, et cetera, et cetera. I've already completed two chapters of this commentary, and it is on its way, and it's working pretty good. But that's why I wanted to write it, and so I thought I'd tell you about it. Thank you very much. Yes. Nobody has anything to say? Okay.
I'm extremely interested in your discussion of the role of the cardinal of this. Do you see what Descartes is doing with the cogito thing as something much more rarefied, obviously, rationality, and its disembodied soul in that sense?
Yes.
Does that lead to, I mean, is there a correlation between that and then a subsequent notion that as rational beings, we can all be one and we don't have to pay much attention to physicality?
Well, I don't think it was that causal.
Okay.
What I'm saying is that I think a number of other factors were correlative with Descartes. Okay. For example, the fact that Descartes and Spinoza were kind of funny intellectual radicals and had to hang out in Holland.
Right.
Now, precisely at the time they're there, Holland is becoming the mercantile center of the world. We can look at the house where Descartes is staying, and you can see what the equivalent of the early stock market, world stock market, is. All right. So what I'm saying is that there's a certain kind of climate which is being expressed in various ways that can lead to this meaning, that Descartes' meaning then becomes correlative with lots of other meanings. Matter of fact, even with certain forms of Calvinism, which is also present in Holland at this time, because you see, Calvin in his own theological way did a kind of Cartesian thing too. That he said, take away all this stuff. We don't need all this stuff to be Christian, all this sacramental guru. He took the warfare against idols to the nth degree. So you see, both from what you might call the specific religious tradition and from these new traditions arising out of, let us say, a philosophical structure of Western thought and the activities that are going on in Holland, and in Holland especially, but also in England, all seem to correlate. In other words, there seems to be a continuity of these meanings, such that if one were of that persuasion, there's a great deal of justification for having a self or non-self of this kind. Of course, it's not the non-self of a Buddhist or anything like that. It's a self that doesn't want to acknowledge the full implications of its activities, see. So I don't want to make a big causal relationship here, but I did want to raise that issue of the constitution of the self within the Western philosophical tradition to say that I would put Du Bois's work alongside that as another alternative to raising that issue. Now, I don't blame everything on Descartes. I think he was quite brilliant myself, but it's just that he went a certain way with the way he was doing it.
Would you attribute the real value to something that is non-corporeal? Then you can go pretty far. What I study is the way in which Asians are reacting negatively to the ease with which we do organ transplants.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, you can see the value within the world right now.
Oh, yes.
The commodification of organs.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
It's car, it's another car.
Oh, yeah. It's exactly. I mean, once a thing has no inherent value and has value only in its exchange, then there's no reason why you can't take the heart out and put it over here, sell it, go out and market, sell that. This thing we were talking about coming up the walk, it's not just, Africans and whatever. I think a lot of poor people get scared sometimes too. Somebody's going to steal me off the street and because they figure nobody knows me or cares about me, they steal me off the street. Next thing you know, I'm dead and they're selling my body parts, you see.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
When you say that the Atlantic is sterile when it comes to gods,
mm-hmm.
do you mean, this is just a point of thought,
mm-hmm.
do you mean the Atlantic after the Europeans arrived, or do you mean to talk about the nature of the Atlantic, with respect to Incas, Aztecs, etc.?
Well, I don't call them Atlantic.
Yeah.
I think I would say the Atlantic manifests itself through its mercantilism. If you wanted to to push that one, and I didn't mention it, that fall of the Atlantic that I see is more an extension of Meringue, and that's what these Roman Catholics, that is the Spanish or the Portuguese or whatever. But they come more as conquerors, out and out conquerors. Or in their language, they came to extend the Christian faith. They came as missionaries in that sense, because there were people in the world who didn't know about Christ. That's putting a nice light on it. And a little gold mixed up in it. But they don't make the Atlantic. That is, if you look at what the Spanish did in the Atlantic, you could say, well, the Spanish could have done that a little bit and gone back home, and Atlantic would have been the same. There's been no extension of meaning, practice, etc., of what they did there. But that mercantile, capitalist, global meaning of the Atlantic really came from the Northern Europeans. Old historians used to say it came from Protestant, from the Protestant world. That is the world that was made possible by Protestants. Then you didn't have to be a Protestant. Everybody got in on that. But it was a world made possible by Protestants. And then Protestants turned into something else. Yankees or whatever you want to call it. So that world, then everybody got involved in it. I mean, after it was done that way, then you found out all kind of people, Danes and Swedes and everybody who could get a boat in the water was out there. But I think the necessity, from the point of view of those people in Europe, a certain necessity of it was from the lowland and from England. You get the lowland, and it's just this little land claimed from the sea, and in a certain sense, even if it's supposed to be a part of the mainland, they're always feeling that they're going to get us, you see? So we have to have some kind of power. Well, we're not going to have land power. So in 1660, can you imagine, in 1660, the largest mercantile fleet in the world was Holland's. Can you imagine this little ship? And then, of course, the English, they just felt, my heavens, we've been saved by the skin of our teeth all the time, but sooner or later they're going to come across that channel. And we have to have some power. That power is not going to be on the mainland. That power has to be in something in this water, see? And this is why then the British make their thing. So that I feel that while a great deal of all this is plausible and understandable, it doesn't deny the sheer facticity, see? It's very strange, because if you looked at it one way, you could say, this is all hindsight, you could say, look, if we knew all of this, nobody needed African slaves. Everything you wanted to accomplish, you could have done it without them. You know? But of course, that's hindsight. The people who got involved in it, they were making fortunes. You know? So existentially, they had to have it. Because it was absolutely free stuff. And this triangulation between Africa, Europe, and the Americas becomes the fundamental structure of a mode of trade and a structure of meaning that tended to perdure everywhere this mercantile capitalist structure found itself. It would always find these equivalents. Sort of reminds me of Dumézil's tripartite theory. It is wherever you went, you found someone to fulfill these roles of this tripartite of Europeans, the kind of mercantile people, and then the Africans. So if you were in the Indian Ocean, you found the same, you know, went to China, whatever, same, you found the Atlantic structure would extend itself.
I'm worried that this question might get slightly convoluted because mm-hmm. I think there's a number of questions mm-hmm. more than one to say. But what I'm curious about is that once when you said that when you were talking about Atlantic atheism, mm-hmm. so that once it also opened up the possibility through its own negation of opening up a new space for a new soul.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious then that if you're tying in Atlantic atheism with a certain introduction of capitalism and an exchange economy, how is it then, and I wonder, I think this ties into your reading of R.K., how is it now in rereading Du Bois and rereading, returning to history, how are we going to open up this new space which is going to overcome this negation?
Like, this is why I want to write the commentary Du Bois and Souls of Black Folk, because I think what he's trying to do is to say that this space that was there to reveal something, but it couldn't be revealed, is still there, and is still there, the possibility, if one is able to reconfigure the meaning of materiality and soul, it can still have a meaning. You see, what gets lost is that soul and materiality become separated, you know? So that you have matter on the one hand, and you have soul on the other hand. One is spiritual, and the other is material, and these things are not. And if you're a materialist, you're bad. And if you simply have soul, you may be happy and spiritual, but you're poor. Mm-hmm. So it's this crazy dichotomy that we find ourselves in. And therefore, to try to make a critique of it, we have to run to people like Karl Marx or the Frankfurt School or something like that. And I'm saying, I don't know what that will work or not. It just sounds, I want to go back to Du Bois's text. And the reason I want to go back to it is because he's talking about this funny, surly character of the African slave trade in a place where you have slaves, they're legally enslaved, and as such they're property, and therefore they have the same meaning of any other property, equivalent to exchange. But here you have human beings who had to realize themselves as human beings, and in that realization had to realize they had inherent value. And they had to have this inherent value, not because they remembered Africa, even though some of them did, and not because they became Christian, even though a lot of them did, but because they had to find a way of affirming the fact simply that they were human. See? Now, I think that's what Du Bois' Souls is about. So that instead of looking at it either as simply something about American racism or simply something that is poetical, I'm placing it within all of the complexity of the beginning of the Atlantic world. And I'm placing it there both as a critical literary text, but also as a religious text. Follow up.
That's what I was really wanting to ask. Mm-hmm. What is this character of the overturning or this ability of the oppressed to affirm themselves outside of this dominant economy? And I'm just curious because I have to confess I'm not that familiar with Du Bois, but where I, you know, from reading this slight passages, anyways, it seems that he is kind of seduced by a Hegelian notion of recognition.
Oh, I don't think so. Not in Souls of Black Folk. He hadn't read Hegel at that time. You see, if you really see, it would be nice if he had. This is why I'm going back and looking at his German stuff. And stuff. I thought he would have gone to Hegel, too. I thought he would just go, oh, man, he went over there to Hegel up. But somehow German philosophy never really was a big thing with him. I mean, he did more history and economic and what Germany would call sociology, but not that side. As a matter of fact, I thought he would have eaten up the Romantics when he was there. Because the way he writes, you know, he can write a lot of flowery cuckoo. And I thought maybe he just loved these German Romantics, and you would find him having taken courses on Goethe and all kind of stuff. No, not true. Now, he may have been in groups or associations where people talked a lot of stuff. I mean, you can go to a place and you study physics all the time, but you're running with people who are talking about novels and poetry and all this kind of stuff. But as far as I would say what the Germans call the, you know, the book that the students have or the professors sign, none of that stuff. But to find the meaning of this, I think is really you find it in strange place. I think it was Schmoller. I think all this comes from Schmoller. That if he was a Romantic, it's only a Romantic in relationship to the kind of meaning of human society that Schmoller has taught him. And if you look at Philadelphia Negro, it's a Schmoller book, because he's looking at the way there can be a self-defined community within the modern world that is able to sustain itself, not totally apart from the modern world, but not absolutely so dependent on it, such that it's part of the mercantile system in such a manner that it falls apart. Like if the stock market falls, then you wipe out, you know, so many thousands of lower middle class families. And you see, this is part of what Schmoller was fighting against. So Philadelphia Negro ends up with part of the possibility of that kind of community in Philadelphia. It's possible that those kind of communities can sustain themselves. See, of course, Schmoller's non-mercantile theory lost ground. Nobody studies that anymore. But when Marx comes along, Marx, first of all, accepts the inevitability of the world system. What?
When in Africa, you have the introduction of Islam, a kind of Islamic mercantilism.
Right, right.
Is there anything having to do with the Islamic concern about idols that leads into a different version of fetishism?
Yes, but I think the Islamic concern with idols is not at the level of making a separation between, you know, body and soul and all that. It is simply saying that there's only God, and God cannot be represented. But I think Islamic mercantilism, accepting mercantilism as a form of human life. And as Marsha Hassan would put it, part of the meaning of Islam as having to do with justice is about justice in exchanges. It's about you must in your exchanges be just. Now, of course, all these, I said something bad about religion, the monotheism, but I mean, that Jews worried about that you have to be just. But they're worried because they were a little small group. They said, especially with each other, within our group. Now, outside, we know we're funny little minorities and we may have to do something different. But you don't do that within your group. Christians who always thought they were better than Jews said, do it in the group. We said, don't do it to anybody because, you know, Jesus is for the whole world. So therefore, you should have just exchanges regardless of whether they're Christian, non-Christian, just because they're human. Of course, Christians cheated on that. But that was their whole thing about usury was precisely to expand it to a notion of humanity. Now, the thing about the Muslims is that their meaning of the law is related directly to their meaning of justice and the meaning of what Allah said. Hodgson used to put it that when the Atlantic world manifested itself, the world was immediately divided into the haves and the have-nots. He said when Islam moved from Arabia to Spain and then from Spain all the way across to the Philippines, that in this movement there was never this great division of have and have-nots. Because the movement was not rapacious in that sense, even though people say they conquered by the sword, that it allowed time for whatever was worthwhile to seep through the whole system. Whereas the Atlantic world, it was so fast. They said, y'all got the stuff down there, we got the machines up here, we're going down there and get that stuff, bring it up here. It was just like that. So in that sense, you could almost say there was no law. There was no law. I think that what I have to avoid in doing this is simply to start pointing up hypocrisies, because that's not what I'm interested in at all. I'm interested in much more descriptions than judgments in that sense. So people will be able to see the formations of certain meanings and how the problem of soul is raised by Du Bois for African people now becomes the problem of soul in the world of globalization.
Now, when you talk about the sterility of the Islamic world as far as gods are concerned, well, there are two things. First of all, isn't it beyond sterility? Isn't there a destruction of a lot of gods in a lot of people in the new world, because a lot of religions disappeared, and the proselytism of Christianity is not only bringing gods to other people, it's mostly taking their gods away. And also the other thing is about atheism. It seems like in the questions and conversations we're having that there's this idea that the market economy in the Atlantic world is bringing about atheism, when it's, again, like I have this general feeling that atheism was a much greater philosophy in the Mediterranean world and still is than it is in the Atlantic world.
Or atheism may be a great philosophy in the Mediterranean world because they are gods. Atheism is relatively unimportant when there are no efficacious gods around. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like being in the Sahara Desert debating about snow. You know? But I think that first issue about destruction of others, I think that it's right. Because it's not only a certain kind of sterility of the gods, it's a certain kind of lack of appreciation, so that one doesn't have the time or sense, the sensibility to regard other gods, other non-human agencies in the world. They become interchangeable too. I mean, you know. For example, it was very hard for a lot of Europeans, not all of them, because when the French came, they didn't come with big families and all that, so they had time, a little time. But but when you say, I don't know why you think you have to have all this land, you know, I mean, you know, you can just live over there, you know, and they don't. It's hard for them to understand that. Having the land meant living with the animals there, living with the trees there. The land is not just I can't inhabit the land just by myself. I mean, I it's not mine, you know. So there are all kinds of forms of that in relationship to the meaning of gods and non-human agencies as they play a role in the life of the human community.
We've had you talking for an hour and a half already, and I think we maybe would like to continue on
an informal basis.
Thank you so much.